The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
Welcome, welcome. It's Thursday night again. I can't believe how quickly it comes around. You're listening to the AutJet Business Show on 101.9 High FM. I'm David Zeidel. And tonight with us, we've got Saul Mervis, the co-owner of the Grill House and Four Nose Bakery. Welcome, Saul.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, Saul's story, it's after beginning his studies in medicine and ultimately finding his way into the restaurant industry quite by accident, he went on to build one of the country's most iconic dining brands. From working as a waiter to becoming a partner and eventually transforming a modest establishment into the renowned Grill House. He has played a pivotal role in shaping South Africa's premium steakhouse experience. More recently, he has taken on the challenge of revitalizing Four Nose Bakery, growing it from a distressed asset into an expanding business with some ambitious plans for the future. With over three decades of experience, a sharp eye for opportunity, and a story that highlights resilience, adaptability, and entrepreneurial instinct, Saul's going to share with us his journey through all of this. But before we get to Saul, I'm going to share our little business story with you tonight. And the story tonight is the second lesson from the book, 18 Steps to Success. And the quote is, "You get more out if you put more in first." And the image with that in the book is a guy looking into a piggy bank, holding it upside down and shaking it, trying to get the money out. And clearly, if he hasn't put the effort of putting the money into the piggy bank beforehand, nothing's going to come out. And I remember often when I was young and looking at doing different things, I kind of wanted a little bit of a guarantee that it's going to work. And I wanted to think, well, is it worth my while? And I wanted to see it almost pay back before I put the massive effort in. And over the years, I've learned that you have to put in first and only then does it pay back. So whatever you're looking at doing, look at it and think, can I and do I want to put in a lot of effort first before I get any payback? And in business, we look at what we call the J curve. And the J curve is, it looks like a J, and you go down first before you go up. And often you need to invest before you see the returns. So that's the business lesson for today. But let's get more business lessons from Saul, the co-owner of the Grill House and Four Nose Bakery. But we'll do that after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show. This is High FM 101.9. And with us tonight is Saul Mervis, the co-owner of the Grill House and Four Nose Bakery, and is about to share with us the story of how he got there. But I know Saul was telling me earlier that at university you did a BSc, and the BSc actually stands for Bachelor of Business Science. But he said his mom had a better explanation for the acronym BSc. Saul, before we get going, really, what did she call the BSc?
Yeah, my mother famously likes to call my BSc a Bachelor of Steak and Chips because pretty much that's all I've done since I've left university. I went into the restaurant industry, as I said to you earlier, and I'll expand upon it a bit later on, quite by mistake, as I feel most people get into the restaurant industry by mistake. There are very few people that choose that hard path. So the Bachelor of Steak and Chips has kind of stuck in our family.
And I thought it was quite funny. You must probably use a lot of these acronyms and things without realizing it, because you got into the steak business by mistake. and you didn't miss the steak. I think you got a big steak in the business. I'm going to stop the puns there. But Just tell us, so you were studying and then you were a waiter at the time. And if you wouldn't mind, just take us through the journey of how did you go from there and which businesses did you get involved with? I remember you had a restaurant at one stage that was selling just hamburgers, and you've been through quite a few. So if you wouldn't mind starting at university and take us through to where you're at now, getting involved with Four Nose Bakery.
Yeah, for sure. Firstly, also, thanks for that great intro. It actually makes me sound like I've done a lot more than I actually have done, being just a basic hamburger mechanic for the last 30-odd years. But the journey started before university. It started at school, actually. I grew up in Klerksdorp, and to earn a little bit of extra pocket money, worked as a waiter. My journey in the restaurant industry started with Spur. Worked at what was then the Nebraska Spur in Klerksdorp for a number of years and earned money that way. So the natural way to continue doing that when I was at university for pocket money was to work as a waiter. And I worked at a number of outlets in Johannesburg back then. Finished my degree and I had 6 months to kill for a few reasons. So where I was working part-time at the time was Late Night Owls, and the group had just opened their second outlet, which was in Mill Park, close to university. I'd seen the signs up, went and applied for a job and worked there. They gave me a full-time job for the 6 months, and I always said to them, it's going to be 6 months and I'm out of here. I had plans to travel. And in those 6 months, I met my current wife, and I also found I had quite a love for the business and enjoyed it. And I got made an offer, a full-time position. That was 30-something years ago, and here I still am in the restaurant industry. As I said, fallen into it quite by mistake.
And so you just started off as an employee. How did you go from being an employee to then getting a serious stake in the business and owning some of the business?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I guess this is what people starting out in business also need to learn, is that if you find something where you feel you do have a future in, or you'd like to make a future in, the most important thing to do is to try and make yourself indispensable and to actually make the people who you work for above you's life easier. So the more you can push them out of the way, the more you can forge your way in, till it gets to a point where when you say to somebody, I would like to either purchase equity in this business or I'm going to have to maybe look somewhere else, they think twice about it and they realize that you are a pivotal part, especially if the business that you're in has got some type of a growth trajectory and they are looking for people to grow with them. And that's where I found myself. I had there were really good partners in the Late Night Owls chain back then. We got on really well, and I almost aggressively, ambitiously forged my way in, because I always knew I was not going to work for somebody for the rest of my life. If I was going to work as hard as I was working, it needed to be meaningful for me, and I needed to build a future in that business. And in order to do that, I needed equity. I needed skin in the game.
But when you say make yourself indispensable, that means adding value to the business. So if you left, they would miss you. Well, in a game like this, and as a waiter, how do you do that? How do you make yourself indispensable?
So at that particular time, I wasn't a waiter anymore. I was made a manager. And I guess you make yourself indispensable by doing, to start with, the really difficult tasks that other people don't particularly want to do. And in the restaurant industry, and you use the word that I hate the most, game. A lot of people say the restaurant game. There is nothing game about a restaurant. If you're in a game, then you're playing the wrong game. This is hard work, as are most industries. But in the restaurant industry, there's a lot of stuff that gets done behind the scenes that people don't know or don't notice. And by getting yourself really entrenched in that, you make yourself indispensable to a point where you are doing tasks other people might not want to do, even if it is temporary, and you're going to move yourself out of that position too.
So can you think of some examples of what that would be that you would do that others don't want to do, but it adds value to the business?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably almost everything that people don't see. So in the restaurant industry, again, what we see, what the customer sees as service, we might see as boring. And those are I always equate the restaurant industry to almost being in a theater, to being on stage. When you're out there, you're a different persona completely. You're in front of a live audience. You're dancing, you're smiling, you're happy, and you're singing. The moment you go behind the scenes, it's a whole different thing. There's heavy equipment to be moved. There's lots of practicing. There's personalities involved. There's shifting involved. It's a completely different what the audience sees on the stage is not what actually brought that successful production to the stage. There were months and months and months of sweat and hard work. So that's similar to the restaurant industry. And I guess a lot of, I keep using the word restaurant industry because that's specifically what we're talking about. What's very hard for us is that we are everything to everyone. So the businesses are generally not big enough to have their own accounting departments, HR departments, maintenance departments. And I guess as you grow the business, and now we're almost at that position, or we're in that position now that we have, which I'm sure we'll get to the bigger brand. But in the beginning, you are everything. You walk in the morning, you're fixing a broken lampshade, you unblocking a blocked drain, you're doing the shifting for the week, you're dealing with somebody who might have a personal family bereavement and you have to counsel them, you're doing the accounts, the books, the everything that has to, you're juggling a lot of things. And if you can successfully do all of that, you're taking a lot of pressure off the people that are working around you, and that's when you make yourself indispensable. So it's menial stuff. It's menial stuff. You setting up the restaurant, you fixing a broken table. There's a whole lot of things. You, the HR department, the electrical department. It's tricky. It's...
So I want to get to your whole story of how you progress. But before that, I want to linger a little bit on more of what you're talking about now.
I mean, well, I'll interrupt you to even say, in this whole discussion that we've had,
yes,
not once yet have I mentioned anything about food.
Yes.
So that's the interesting part. Like if I had 50 cents for every time somebody had said to me, my wife's a great cook, I should build her a restaurant, I would have retired by that already. It is, as much as it is about feeding people, it is so much more than just about the food. It's about how you make people feel. You know, I always say there's a massive difference between service and hospitality. Service is something that you'll get out of a vending machine. You pop your 10 rand in and out pops a Coke. Hospitality is so much more about how you make people feel than about actually serving them. And generally, you find that people do spend more money in places that they feel comfortable. So getting back to what I said, the food is obviously the ultimate important part about it. But what goes on around getting that food to the plate is really the trick between the difference that makes one restaurant, I guess, more successful or more sustainable than another.
So you almost answered the question before I asked it, because that was exactly what I was going to get onto. What are you really selling? So people are paying for the food, but you, what I'm hearing from you is you're selling more than just the food. What do you want people to leave with at the end, other than having a great meal? If you had to encompass it into one thing, what are you really selling?
I'm selling an experience.
An experience.
So that is the reason why the Grill House is not on Uber Eats. Uber Eats is a transaction. Uber Eats is a phone call. The food arrives. It does not do my food justice. Now, I'm not saying Uber Eats is a necessary evil. And believe me, the numbers we're doing in Uber Eats, which is a whole nother discussion through the Fornos brand, is astonishing. And I don't think you can think of any restaurant experience of late that you've walked into a restaurant and there haven't been five guys with motorbikes and a hoodie and a backpack waiting for something. Uber Eats is a necessary evil and it's not going away and you need to deal with it properly. But Uber Eats is not a Grill House thing. A Grill House is walking in, being greeted by somebody who cares, possibly or preferably knows your name, being seated properly at a table with a white tablecloth, knives and forks that have been polished, glasses that are glimmering, the sounds and the smells of a restaurant, a waiter who looks good coming to actually engage with you as opposed to just being an order taker. Those are experiences that have taken us years to hone in on. And I'm selling two things. I'm selling the experience and I'm selling hopefully the meeting of that person's, or even exceeding that person's expectations. So a question I often get asked, and maybe I'm beating you to it again, is why the Grill House has lasted so long. And that goes down to one word we believe, and that's consistency. So we have a lot of regular customers, and our aim is to be able to meet or exceed their expectations every single time. And that's really what we're selling.
That's amazing. And I'd heard the term of it's in business, it's the little things that make the big things happen. And that's exactly what I'm hearing from you, that the knife must be shining and the glass must be glittering. And that's without even, as you said, talking about the food.
So that's what we refer to as simply attention to detail.
Mm.
And attention to detail doesn't come by mistake. It's hard work as well. And often you find that if you've been in the same shop or the same business for so long, you get what's called shop blindness, and you'll walk past something every day unnoticed or even noticed and not deal with it. And there's a very famous saying that we have in our industry as well, is that if you accept it, then you condone it. So you can't accept something that's par or below par standard. And that attention to detail, what I said earlier on about being boring, is the importance of the business. So for argument's sake, every day somebody is responsible for taking the mustards, opening them up, cleaning the lids of the mustards, wiping down the bottle and putting them down. So that when a customer comes and sits down, asks for the English mustard and opens it up, there isn't crusted mustard on the inside of the lid. Now that is as important as the steak being perfectly medium rare. And every person in the restaurant industry has a role to play that affects every other person. And it's very similar to a sports team, a soccer match. The leading goal scorer might take the acclaim, but he's not scoring those goals if he hasn't got a strong midfield passing to him and a strong defense stopping attacking. And the restaurant industry is exactly the same. Unfortunately, your entry-level employee is often referred to as your sculler. And the sculler is the guy who cleans the plates. And it is an unskilled labor, but his job might be the most important, because the guy putting a beautiful medium rare fillet on your plate, if he puts it on a dirty plate, that when the customer puts their hand underneath and feels something and lifts up the plate and sees some old spinach on the bottom of the plate because the plate hasn't gone through the dishwasher properly, that sculler has affected every single thing that you've been trying to achieve right throughout. So that's the attention to detail that you have to pay from. And the customer's experience starts not when they walk in the door. It starts from in their mind when they decide to come and eat in your restaurant. That's when the anticipation starts, and that's when the experience starts. So possibly the second most important person might be the one who answers the telephone. Now, obviously, with DinePlan and all the online booking platforms, those dynamics have changed. But generally, we get a lot of customers who still pick up the phone and book a table. If the person answering that phone call is not answering with a smile on their face, and there's a sound of boredom or irritation, already that customer's anticipation is a little bit dodgy of what's going to happen. The next thing is make sure you meet what they asked for, and that's not difficult. If a customer says, I would like a table by the window, make sure they get that table by the window. And what we try and do is we will try and replicate that each and every experience. So we have notes next to customers' names, which tell us what they preferred or didn't like at their previous visit to the restaurant. So we have a booking for David Zardell. He likes to sit on table 4. You will come, you'll sit on table 4 every time. You might not notice it, but that's where you'll sit and you'll be comfortable. That is attention to detail. The way the waiter approaches you and greets you. And I can tell you my 3 worst words in my restaurant industry are when you call a waiter over and he says to you, I'll get your waiter.
Mm.
If that's 3 words, I'll get your waiter 4 words. Those are the worst 4 words you can hear.
Mm.
Engage with the customer there and then.
Right.
Sort out what you need to sort out afterwards. But the customer is the raison d'etre. The reason that we are there is for the customer. So that can ruin a customer's experience. And again, I go back to all of these little quirks that we have in our industry. You can save a bad meal with good service, but you can never save bad service with a great meal.
Wow, I like that.
Whenever we get, and we get a lot of responses from customers on the DinePlan platform, I would say that, thank goodness, we get mainly 5 out of 5 stars, but every now and then something, it's a numbers game and something can go wrong. But what I always point out to my management is that actually of the bad reviews that we get, which thank goodness are few, I would say 90% of the bad reviews are experiential or service related. They'll tell you the steak I had was overcooked, but actually the manager didn't really take much notice of me, or I had to wait 40 minutes for the customer, for the waiter to bring a drink. They found a fault in the food because they weren't made to feel special in the service. And that's an important aspect of our business.
Wow. So when you talk about it, you said it's like a team that you're together. So just from a payment point of view, and just before I get there, it reminds me of that story of at NASA where they building and they're putting sending a rocket to space, and a guy's sweeping the floor, and they say to him, "What are you doing here? What's your job?" And he says, "I'm putting a ship on the moon." He knows that cleaning the floor properly is helping that get to the moon. So it's a team effort. How do you reward the waiters if you're doing it as a team? Well, not just the waiters, but the scholar. So I'm the waiter at a table and I get the 10% and it's a nice tip. Do I keep that, or is that something that is shared amongst everyone?
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting question. And it's not a straightforward answer. And a lot of restaurants do things differently. We are firm believers that the waiters earn their own tips and keep their own tips. We will, as an establishment, incentivize our other staff based on good or bad experiences. I'd like to say we are good payers of our staff. There's some restaurants that, and I don't want to get into it, but there's some people that really do take advantage, unfortunately. I think that judging by the fact that I still have staff with me that have been with me for the full 30 years that I've been, or 32 mm-hmm. years that the Grill House has been, I've got guys that are, I mean, my main griller in my Rosebank store is a guy by the name of Paulus, and he is an absolute rock star. I think I might have spent more hours next to him in the last 35 years than I have next to my wife. Like, we are close, and it is a Grill House family. We like to treat it as such, but in terms of remuneration, the tips that the waiters get, the waiters keep. That's just how the industry, I believe, should work. There's some people that spread it around, and there are actually some restaurants that actually take the tips away from the waiters and then spread it throughout the entire shop, which may or may not have its pros and cons. I just know what works for us, and that's how our waiters are incentivized to do better.
So I want to get back now to a little bit of your general journey where you are now, and then we'll unpack some of the other lessons that you've learned, but we'll do that after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to Chai FM 101.9. I'm David Zeidel. This is AutJet Business Show, and we've got a fascinating talk at the moment with Saul Mervis, the co-owner of the Grill House and Four Nose Bakery. And we haven't even got into that yet. But some of the amazing things that Saul has shared with us so far is that you need to be indispensable in the role that you take so that you can grow with the business and that people will understand what you're doing or experience what you're doing and not want to lose you. And that means you've got to do some of the hard stuff. That's some of the stuff that other people don't want to do. You've got to understand that service is not hospitality. They are different things. And people are there for the experience and that they can be consistent with that. And in order to do that, you've got to pay attention to detail. And then just before the break, you shared a quote that I thought was fantastic. You said, "You can save a bad meal with good service, but you can't save bad service with a good meal." Do you want to expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, so a customer goes out to be made to feel special. There are not a lot of people that know. There are a lot of people that know the difference between like a lousy meal and a good meal. There are not a lot that are discerning enough to know the difference between a good meal and a great meal. The great meal is more about how they've been made to feel while they're there. People eat out to transfer themselves into another experience, almost another world, or they are doing it to celebrate an occasion. or they were doing it to impress a business partner or a business associate to clinch that deal. So the way they are being made to feel is exceptionally important. Now, if a customer has a bad meal or what they perceive to be a bad meal and they fobbed off, they're going to really hate that experience. Mm. If they've had a bad meal, which can happen, and that's been dealt with really well, you're actually turning what was a negative experience into a more positive experience than had it have just been a neutral experience, if that makes sense to you. We have won over customers and made lifelong supporters by having dealt with what was potentially a negative situation in the correct way and turned it into a positive situation. And like the three best words you ever want to hear a customer saying are the famous Arnold Schwarzenegger words, "I'll be back." Like when a customer walks out and says, "That was great, I'll be back," you know that you've achieved your goal with that customer.
So it's interesting. I went to get some takeaways from a restaurant yesterday, in fact. And the guy just before me had booked a table and they had messed up the booking at the table. This wasn't at your restaurant. This is another restaurant. And the woman said, "Yes, sorry, it was my mistake, but we're full. We got no tables for you." And the guy was almost begging to stay there. He said, "Can you please just make a plan?" Like he had his family with him. "Can you get a table? Can you?" And she was absolutely no. And I almost felt like I don't want to go back there on his behalf, because it was a terrible service. It's exactly the opposite of what you're saying. I mean, there's a quote, and I think it's a Maya Angelou quote, that says, "People might forget what you've said, but they'll never forget how you made them feel."
Exactly.
And that's what I'm hearing you say.
And so what's fascinating is that people, restaurant owners, particularly those that are not that hands-on, will spend an untold fortune of money building these beautiful restaurants. They will create fantastic menus. They will plate beautiful food. But they won't pay attention to that person who's the front line of defense with the customer. That's your gatekeeper. And if somebody's not getting past that person, then there's a problem. Like that person has to be really the right person at that front door.
Interestingly enough, that person in this case was the owner, which made it even even worse. So how do you ensure that that happens? What are some of the things, if you can think back, that you've done that will turn a bad experience into a good experience? Because your first thing is to say, well, you can come back for another free meal, but that doesn't change this experience. Can you share with us some of the things that you would do to turn it around?
So the most important thing is, if you have made a mistake, own the mistake. Don't deny that there's a problem. And what I think is also really important is, people say the customer is always right, but that's not entirely true. However, the customer is always the customer, and they have the right to be wrong. And that's the difference. And you need to understand, you know, if somebody says to me, "This is not a fillet, this is a rump." Now, I've been doing it long enough to know the difference between a fillet and a rump. There I can actually dig my heels in and say, "It actually is a fillet. I'm happy to change it if you want to, but that is a fillet." The gray area comes in when a customer says, "I ordered this medium rare and this is medium." Now, your medium and my medium might be slightly different. And there you have to deal with the customer as if to say, "Well, you know, with pleasure, we'll sort that out for you. We'll change it." But own the problem always. Don't make the customer feel like what's really important is you need to understand that if a customer does complain, what they're really doing is giving you the opportunity to have a second chance to make it right. Because the most difficult situation, or the most dangerous situation, should I say, is a customer who leaves your restaurant unhappy and quiet. They don't say anything. And worse yet, they say something to a friend or two friends, or go out on this really fabulous thing called social media, which has changed our business irreversibly. But that's another 3-hour discussion for another day. If a customer verbalizes their problem, whether you think they're right or you think they're wrong, deal with it. Make sure that they feel that you care. Do it properly, as if you do have to care. You can't pretend to care, because that's going to be seen right through as well. Own the problem, care about it, try and find out why they were upset about it, and resolve it there and then as best as you possibly can. Never ignore it. Never. If I do get a bad review, I'm on the phone straight away. Like I'm phoning that customer and we're finding out what went wrong. How can we fix it? And I'll never force people to come back. I'll always offer them the opportunity to come back as my guest. And I'm honest with them. I say, you've given me the opportunity to make it right. Like we're in the business of making friends, not making enemies. Mm-hmm. If something goes wrong, in every business, things can go wrong. Head on, deal with it, own it, fix it.
That's incredible. And then let's go back into your route. So you started off by just being a waiter. Then you bought into the business. And then just take us through your journey all the way through to now taking over a whole new chain that is different to your main business.
Okay, yeah, that'll turn the discussion into a whole other trajectory, but so be it. When I started with the Late Night Owls Group, it was back in 92, 93, somewhere around there, 90, in fact. And in those days, there were quite a lot of family steakhouses in Johannesburg. I can name a few of them, but maybe some of your listeners will be too young to even remember them. But we needed to find our own unique selling point. Mm. We needed to find something different. So we traveled back then predominantly in the States. There's a very famous food show that happens in Chicago every year. We spent some time there. We looked at restaurants in Chicago, in New York, and we identified the need to elevate the meat eating experience from being a steakhouse to a grill house to being what we call white tablecloth dining. So as much as it wasn't fine dining, because I'll never profess to be a fine dining restaurant, we are meat and potatoes people. That's what we do. We just like to think we do lots of meat and potatoes, and we like to think we do meat and potatoes well, but ostensibly that's what we are. We're meat and potatoes. We changed the whole nature of how we serve people, and we built the grill house as it is now. It was called Al's Grill House then, back in 93, and we elevated to a grill house dining experience. We had to change the way waiters looked. We had to change the way waiters served. We were the first ones to bring that big bread on the board. We were the first ones to use proper steak knives, the big wooden handle steak knives. And as I said to you earlier on when we were just chatting, we're very flattered in that a lot of restaurants followed suit in that. We don't take that as a threat at all. We take that as a compliment to what we had done. And ever since then, we've tried to also reinvent ourselves on a regular basis. We were the first ones to do private dining rooms. We were the first in the single malt whiskey world. Subsequently, Catsy's, our piano bar, which was then a piano bar, then became a jazz bar, and now is more of a live venue destination. We were always the biggest stockists of single malt whiskeys, cognacs, etc., which back then, when they were very hard to get hold of, was quite a big draw card. So yeah, that's been the progression through the grill house phases. And as I said to you earlier on, our biggest emphasis has been on consistency without the boredom. We've tried to reinvent ourselves, try to do new dishes. Although the funny thing is, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And the customers want what the customers want. A 300-gram fillet, pepper crusted, medium rare with chips is probably your biggest selling staple diet. We have introduced quite a lot of more exotic meats. We're doing quite a bit of USDA, Argentinian, Wagyu, that type of stuff. In fact, I was just on the phone now to supply on the way here. He's going to supply me some really nice Wagyu burgers, which we're going to do some Wagyu smash burgers and just play around with that and do different stuff. But the basics stay the same. And our emphasis is on what you brought up earlier on about the waiters as well, is how do we achieve that? I don't like to use the word waiter training, because training is a term that tends to come to an end. You've trained. We use the word waiter maintenance or staff maintenance, and we're continually trying to reinvent ways of serving. We bring in suppliers, whether they meat suppliers or wine suppliers, to train our waiters on their product, and we're continually training them to teach them to do things in a better way. Then to get back to the foremost thing, yeah, so that was an interesting experience, and we took over the brand in January 2025. It's been a learning curve. So food service is food service, hospitality is hospitality, And if you understand and comfortable with that part of the business, you can do it across the board. But the nuts and bolts of different industries in within the food business are different. I'm not a baker. I've never baked before. And now all of a sudden I find myself, although my one part, so I have two partners, Peter Williams and Marius Delaray. Marius was in the corporate space for a long time, but prior to that he was in the food industry. And that's how this deal came to us, through his corporate connections. It was owned by a private equity company and they wanted to move this asset off their books and they approached us. We took it on and we've been learning a lot. It's been a challenge. We like to say baking's a contact sport. Baking's hard work. There's nothing easy about baking, from the hours to the product to quantities of deciding what to sell, when to sell them. So we've sunk ourselves deep into this. We went to a really interesting trade show in Dusseldorf last year called IBA, which is the biggest bakery convention in the world. It was an absolute eye opener. I wasn't sure if I was in an engineering convention or an art convention or a food convention, because baking is all of the above. Baking is creativity, it's passion, it's labor, and it's engineering. The engineering aspect is huge. The equipment is massive. So we're coming to grips with that now. We're not unclear as to the challenges that we have ahead of us. And so many of my Grill House customers have said to me, wow, we've been to Furnace recently, we've definitely noticed a change, but what else are you going to do? And we know we have a lot to do. Mm. When we took over the brand, there were 12 stores. We have just recently built our first one since we've taken over in Parktown, just off the St. Andrews off-ramp. Not Parktown North, but Parktown itself. And that's really working nicely. And we're currently busy with 4 new venues. So hopefully by July, there'll be 17 stores, which also helps. It plays into, because we have a central bakery and a central kitchen, and it plays into that as well in terms of quantities. Every store bakes its own product. So like our definition of a good bakery, because there are lots of bakeries, but our definition of a good bakery is the reduction of the time between the oven and your mouth. So if we don't have to transport products, and ours are all, everything's handmade, and we don't use preservatives, if we don't have to transport a product, that's first prize. We're not individually packing, blast freezing, putting it away, moving it hundreds of kilometers overnight. We bake, it gets rolled out the oven, and it gets picked off the shelf by the customer, hopefully still hot and fresh. And that, if we can achieve that, that's our prime goal for a bakery point of view. We've got some nice revamps in the pipeline for some of our existing stores. Our flagship store is obviously Dunkeld, but one that we're building now in Four Ways, which I just came from a few minutes ago, there's a new development on the corner of the Four Ways Mall called The View, on the corner of Cedar and Witkoppen. And it's going to be quite an iconic corner. There are us and 3 other big brand food operators coming there. We'll be the first ones. We'll hopefully be open by somewhere around the middle of May. And that's going to be a slightly different look and feel for us. But we don't want to lose the look and feel. Mm. We want people to walk in and say, we are definitely in a Furnace, but something's different, something's fresher, something's brighter. So that's been our challenge. The group we inherited with some amazing staff. Like, it's just the Furnace team is a great team of people, and we've enjoyed it, and we think that they've also enjoyed, because they were a little bit rudderless for the last 5 years while they were owned by a private equity company and not so much hands-on by restaurant / hospitality people. And I think we've brought that back. We brought back the motivation. You know, people love to be acknowledged.
Yeah.
You know, there's another famous saying, like a pat on the back is only 3 vertebrae higher than a kick in the ass. And people like to be patted on the back as well as. And that's an important aspect of what we do. We're reinvesting in people and in how they feel as well. And that's our challenge with Furnace. But we are excited. We're not unclear, as I said, to the hard work. And the hours are very different to steakhouse hours. So if I was burning it at both ends, I'd be on the grill until 10 o'clock at night in the grill house. And I could actually move right across to our Rosebank Furnace, which The night shift comes in at 8 o'clock in the evening and bakes through the night. So it's a 24-hour business. But the two businesses work well. We're leveraging the two of them, and that's working well for us as well.
Fantastic. I want to now get to the finances of the business. This is a business show. So for people who are looking at other businesses, what can they learn from the finances of your business? But we'll do that after the break.
The AutJet Business Show provides mentoring, inspiration, and invaluable networking opportunities to help turn your vision into reality. Let's build your business empire together.
You're listening to the AutJet Business Show on 101.9 Chai FM. I'm David Zeidel, and we're learning about the restaurant business, but more than the restaurant business, we're learning about the service business and the experience business. From the co-owner of the Grill House and Four Nose Bakery, Saul Mervis. And Saul, just before the break, I wanted to ask you, and I mentioned we were going to talk about this, is the margins or the business of the restaurant business. You now got two different types of businesses. How do you, and you can choose anyone or both of them. Somebody starting in a business like this, and always from a financial point of view, is how do I make money from a business like this? How do you know that you're giving the customer everything that they want, but you're still making profits from that? Do you have a template or a method on how you price things?
Yeah, so there's no silver bullet to that. And that's probably one of the most difficult parts about the restaurant industry. And every restaurant's different. Like you say, the Grill House, your spend per head with a customer in the Grill House is much higher than your spend per head in a Four Nose, obviously. The Grill House, you're selling steaks, red wine, but your costs to run that are higher than your costs to run a Four Nose. Our food, we try and achieve a GP in the steak industry of around about 52 to 55%.
When you say GP, can you explain to someone who doesn't understand what a GP is?
So that's your gross profit. That's your gross profit before all your fixed expenses, etc. So if you swing GP around, the other side of GP is what we call food cost. So if you are achieving a 54% GP, your food cost is 46%, if that makes sense, your actual cost of sales. Mm. And those things have to be, in the bakery space, your GPs are higher. You can achieve a better GP, but then you're selling a 9.50 rand sausage roll. You've got to sell a lot of sausage rolls or a 32 rand croissant. And the challenge in the bakery industry is nobody wants to walk into a bakery and buy the second last loaf of bread. You have to look like you're full the whole time. So you have to balance what you're overmaking versus what you're going to throw away at the end of the day. And that's tricky. Your interesting question is, how do you price? So there are two ways of pricing. One is on a fixed margin that you say to yourself, okay, this is what it costs me to produce a croissant or to put a steak on a plate. And I'll get to that just now as well, because it's a lot more complex than just the product. If for argument's sake, it costs me 10 Rand to make a croissant and I'm selling it for 30 Rand, then my markup is X. It's a 33% cost. My markup is 60, whatever. That's one way of doing it. In the coffee world, in the croissant world, in the steak world. But for better or for worse, there is a cap that the market are prepared to pay for certain things. And there is competition out there which people will compare certain staple items to. Coffee being one of them, a Coke, a beer being another, a burger being another. So you can't exceed that. So you have to, whenever we do price changes, we look at each item individually, we cost it scientifically, what it cost us to put on the plate or to sell, and what we're selling it at. And then I do a spreadsheet with about 7 or 8 of my perceived closest competitors, and I'll see where they at with that. And if most people are selling an item for, let's say, 60 Rand, and my actual markup that I want to achieve gets me to sell it for 65 Rand, I'm going to have to drop that to 60 or 61 Rand to be cognizant of what's happening in the marketplace. Unfortunately, things like wars break out, things like diesel go up, and prices have become incredibly fluid at the moment. And it's hard to keep changing prices. So sometimes you're going to take a knock and there's swings and roundabouts. You also have to understand that your percentage markup shrinks based on the cost of the item. So we don't bank percentages, Dave, we bank rands. Mm. So I would rather sell a 600 rand bottle of wine for 600 rand and bank 400 rand with a lower margin percentage-wise than bank 40 rand on a hamburger, if that makes sense, with a higher margin, or on a sausage roll bank 3 rand with a much higher margin. So it's a, there is no exact science on how to do this, and everyone's got their own take on the best way to do it.
So when you're looking at your margins and you're looking at the cost of the steak, what do you include in that? Do you include just the cost of the actual ingredients, or do you include the cooking time and the cleaning time and the rental time, or is it purely the input cost?
When you talk about food cost, and again, everyone's got a different take on this. When you talk about food cost, we refer to the actual cost of putting that product on a plate.
So it's so, everything?
No. The cost of that product. I won't take a rental factor into it or a wage factor. And you should. You should take an electricity factor into it, especially in the baking world, because that's become the biggest portion of our cost right now is electricity. But what we'll do is we'll say, it cost me X amount of rand to bring in that hind quarter of meat. I deboned it, so a rump cost me X per kilogram. And if that's what it cost me per kilogram, a 300 gram rump cost me Y. So that's the cost of the steak. But then I've got to add the basting that we use to cook it, or the crusting that we use to cook it. Like, we go down to the minutiae. I've got to add the chips that we put on the plate, or the vegetables that we call a plate cost, and we somehow manage to balance that out. But my margins are based on the cost of that item to put it on the plate. The rest is a sunken cost based on that. So, I mean, back in the day, you had three costs when you ran a restaurant. It was rent, cost of sales, in other words, your purchasing product, and labor. There's a fourth really scary one now, and that's electricity. And electricity in some of my restaurants, believe it or not, is almost as much as the rent. It's become ridiculously prohibitive, and customers don't necessarily see that. But yeah, the food cost is based on the actual cost to put that item on a plate.
And you still got to take into account the stuff that people send back, whether, as you said, somebody says they wanted it raw and not medium raw.
Yeah.
Does that get factored in at some stage, or is that just an extra expense?
So it's both. It does get factored in. From a stock point of view, we'll calculate that in as a cost. It gets rung off to a different department, whether it be waste, promotions, etc. A percentage discount. You know, we get a lot of the airline crews coming in and they want a discount on the meal. So that factors into it as well. So we do calculate it as part of what our expenses are in the business, definitely.
Great. We're kind of running out of time here. And I just wanted to ask you, just in general, for somebody who's looking to get into business or looking at different ways of looking at business, let's say you're looking at your kids, they're finishing university now, and you want to give them two or three quotes on just how to be successful in life. And you can repeat maybe some of what you've said or something new. What would let's take three things. What would be the three key things that you think someone in general should look at to be successful in business and in life in general?
I think I would probably be a lot more successful if I knew the answer to that question. You started off by talking about a J. You said that business goes down and then comes up. I think that the J is a lot more of a W. I think it goes up and down and up and down and up and down again. You have to have, as you said, faith in yourself. You have to be brave enough to understand if something is not what you want it to be, and know when to walk away from it. And you have to have the energy to see it through to the very end, I would believe. I also would say to people, don't be scared of asking for help. Don't be scared of asking for advice. And I think that the generation that we're churning out now, very differently from our generation, is one of immediate gratification, which can be dangerous. And I think also, very importantly, social media has changed how people see things forever. And there was a guy, there's a restaurant guru that I love to listen to, and I've seen him live a few times, by the name of Jim Sullivan, and he brought out a book called Mind Your Own Business. And he uses that term in both senses of the word. Mind your own business in terms of taking care of your own business, look after your own business and mind your own business in terms of not being so worried about what's out there. Focus on what you're doing, be proud of what you're doing, and mind your own business. If you want to run a successful business, you need to be prepared to love it, wake it up in the morning, and put it to bed at night, and not farm it out to somebody else to do that.
Wow, that's incredible. So just from this stuff that you've said have faith in you, in yourself, and the energy to work through it. Don't be scared to ask for help if you need it, and focus on what you're doing. And I love that quote that you said from Jim Sullivan of mind your own business from the two sides. And I've never heard before, rather than the J curve, the W, but it's almost like a continuous W. And that's what business is really. And I want to go back to the quote you said earlier of, you can save a bad meal with good service, but you can't save bad service with a good meal. And I really think that applies to everything, not just the restaurant business.
True.
And you need to have a slogan in your business, like a focus. And the focus that I heard from you was reduce the time from the oven to the mouth. And you must know what you're aiming for. So I hope that some of the lessons that Saul has given us has been unbelievable, and that you can use it in your business. I want to thank you, Saul Mervis, the co-owner of the Grill House and Four Nose Bakery, for all this input that you've put in. I'm David Zeidel, and this has been the Orchard Business Show.